This is the audio interview for William Frederick Harding. You go by Bill. Hey, Bill, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
We are doing this for the Sugar Hill Historic Preservation Society. Are you okay with me recording this?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So we'll go ahead and get started. So go ahead and give me your full name again.
My full name is William Frederick Harding. That's with a T, not a D. Everybody gets that messed up. But anyways, that's my name, William Frederick Harding. I go by Bill and some other names, which you'll hear later on in this interview.
Okay. Where were you born at?
I was born in Albany, New York. Lived most of my years up there. As a youngster, around 7 years old, moved to Colony, New York. And after that, we moved to West Albany, New York. West Albany is known for its first prize Tobin packing plant, which they just tore down here recently. But anyways, West Albany was basically an Italian-type village. Very small, very close-knit families. Went to school at West Albany, which was the elementary school, and from there went to Elisha Hill, which was up in Colony. Graduated from Colony Central High School. Went from Colony Central High School to Hudson Valley Community College and studied mechanics there for 2 years. And then I went to work for the state of New York at Sunny, which is the university, as a cleaner. I was about the age of 23 at that point in time. And from there, we'll go to the next, my military service.
Okay. So what was it like growing up in Albany?
Albany was fine. I mean, I was born in 49. So I don't remember too much, but until I say about the age of 3 to 4, it was the time when you were able to go ahead and sit on your front steps. You knew your neighbors, everybody knew each other. It was a lot different times than it is today. I wish we could go back there.
Right. After you worked at 23 at the State University of New York as a cleaner and a janitor, how did you get involved with the military and what branch of military?
Well, that's a good question, because at that point in time, at the age of 23, I was working from 10 at night to 6:30 in the morning. And I was in a rut. And I had to get a change. And I looked at the different branches of service. And the Army at that point in time wanted to join you. And I didn't need anybody else in my rut that I was in. And then when I went down to the recruiting office, I looked in the windows and I saw that beautiful, beautiful set of dress blues, which was the Marine Corps. And then I took my test in Marine Corps. I wanted military police at the time because I had been trying to get into the state police, Capitol Police, actually, for quite a while, and that didn't pan out. So I went in, I enlisted for the military police. And at that point in time, the recruiter told me the quota was full, but all he did is he went ahead and signed me up for 2 years, active duty. And he said, once you get down to boot camp, you tell him that you want to see the career planner. And I said, oh, that's great. So in 1973, I went ahead and I enlisted into the Marine Corps. I went to Parris Island, and of course, when I get down to Parris Island, it's a whole other story. And I don't think we have enough time on this interview. But anyways, I was not able to see a career planner at the time. And I went through the boot camp and came out of Marine and was stationed to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. I spent 2 years in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina in the infantry or rifleman, but I worked in the company office. And from there, I reenlisted and went into data processing, still at Camp Lejeune. And I was at Camp Lejeune for approximately 6 years. And then it was my turn to go to Okinawa, Japan for 2 years. Before I went there, I had gotten married in 76, November of 76, to a beautiful wife, Kathy. And we lived there on Camp Lejeune for a while. And I went to Okinawa, Japan, unaccompanied. And then we went ahead and made arrangements for her to come over for a year. And she spent some time over in Okinawa, Japan with me. And then from Okinawa, Japan, I received orders for a place real close to home, which was called Albany, Georgia. Or you mention it, Albany, Georgia. So I was stationed down in Albany, Georgia, and working in the computer field. And we were there for approximately 4 or 5 years. And my parents, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, they were living in Albany, New York, and they came down with their little trailer and stayed with us for a while down in Albany, Georgia, and they liked it, so they sold their house up there in Albany, New York, and moved down to Albany, Georgia. Well, as the military goes, after you're at station a while, they gave me a choice of going to recruiter school or DI school. And I said I'd go to recruiter school. So they sent me to San Diego, just me. Meanwhile, Kathy and my parents, they were all there in Albany. So once I finished recruiter school, I was stationed in a place called Clyde, Ohio. Up in Clyde, Ohio, I was there for 9 months, and it was a very difficult time because I had a quota of 5 people a month, and half the people couldn't pass the ASVAB, which is the entrance test, reading, writing, comprehensive, and speaking English. Speaking English, I mean, as far as putting sentences together and so on. But anyways, had a very difficult time recruiting, and I requested my relief in 9 months, and they were nice, and they sent me to California. So Kathy and I, we moved to Fallbrook, California, and I was stationed there at Camp Pendleton in the data processing field. And at Camp Pendleton, once we got there, it was like going home. There was a whole different world from being on the outside. Working with civilians, and very nerve-wracking. Anyways, so going along Camp Pendleton, I was there for, 10 years, because I became a California resident. After 10 years, you become a resident of the state. So I got out in 86, I got out of the Marine Corps and looking for jobs, and lo and behold, I ended up with a job with a contracting company here in Atlanta, Georgia, in the data processing field. I was working for a company called GT Wireless. And in 20-some-odd years ago, we moved to Chelsea Park, and we had an apartment there. And then we were looking for a home, for a house. And lo and behold, we ended up here in Sugar Hill. And we've been here in Sugar Hill for, like I said, over 20 years. And loving it. and love the people. We've seen this place grow. I know a lot of people are saying it lost a lot of its small town feeling, but if you get involved and volunteer in different things and you talk to people, you get that small town feeling right back again. Even though you have big buildings and everything else around, you still get that small town feeling. So that's basically it in a nutshell. What's your next question, Kim?
Okay. So why Sugar Hill? What if you were working in Atlanta, which, you know, it's a good bit away from Sugar Hill, what brought you to Sugar Hill?
Well, like I said, we looked around and didn't have much money at the time. So we saw Sugar Hill. We checked out Duluth. We checked out. We didn't want to be downtown because at that point in time, I started working in Alpharetta for GTE Wireless. And that's before it became Verizon. So I didn't want to be in the city and didn't want to live in an apartment anymore because we had already been living in an apartment. So the pricing on housing was very decent up here in Sugar Hill. And, you know, it just looked like a nice community, and we were able to go ahead and find a house that we fell in love with. And like I said, at that point in time, Sugar Hill was nothing like it is today. City Hall wasn't built. The window factory was there. The big church was there. But it was just good, nice neighborhood, and it was close to where I had to go to work. I had multiple ways of getting to work, and Kathy at the same time, she was working down there in Norcross. So it was kind of an easy commute way to get to wherever we had to go for work. I mean, Walmart wasn't even built yet. The mall wasn't built yet. So it was just a nice little house that we got, and the price was right, and we moved to Sugar Hill.
Okay. So let's jump back a little bit. Tell me some interesting facts about your parents. Who are your parents? And give me some interesting facts about them.
Well, my parents, love them dearly. My mom is 105. My dad's 98. My dad was born in Westringen, Germany, which is no longer by that name. It's now called Wilhelmshaven. It's up by the North Sea. Interesting fact, my grandfather fought under the Kaiser Wilhelm in the First World War. Later on, being a blacksmith like he was, he helped build the Bismarck by forging the anchor chains for the Bismarck. My dad and his three brothers came from Germany, landed in Ellis Island with his mom, dad, his mom, and his father, and the three brothers. My father's the youngest. He's the only one that's still surviving. They came to Ellis Island. My father's grandfather, when you came in to Ellis Island, when you migrated from Germany to Ellis Island, they had to have a sponsor at that point in time. And my father's grandfather, my father's grandfather was already here in America, and he lived up in Schoharie, New York. So he was the sponsor. So he took them in, and that's when they moved from there. And all brothers and mother were all moved up to Albany, New York, along with the father. And that was my father's side. Now, my mother's side, her relatives are all Canadian. So you can imagine a French and a Canadian getting together, and that's my mom and dad. Her family came from up in Montreal, Canada. And it was funny because all the time while growing up, living in West Albany, just about every other year or every 2 years, the Canadians would come down for a visit with my mom, her sister, and brothers, two brothers that she had. They were all here in Albany. And it was like, I learned a little bit of French, like, comme talibou, parlez vous français, parlez très bien, oui, and so on and so forth. They would come down during the summer, and it was like a family reunion type deal. Of course, my father and I are looking at each other saying, what are these people saying? But anyways, it was a good family life. And now that they are married, they've been married since 1945, which makes it 80 years that they've been married. They still live in their own house. They take care of each other. They have no caretaker except Kathy and I. We do a normal visit about every week, sometimes twice a week for doctor's appointments and just family get-togethers and suppers and stuff like that. But like I said, my dad's 98, so he's having a hard time getting around, walking. When we go out, he has a wheelchair that we use. Mom, she's at 105 and still, she's like the Energizer Bunny. She can't hear too good, but don't get in her way. So, yep, that's my parents.
And they live near you?
They live in Beaufort.
Okay, all right. Yep. All right.
They used to live down in Albany, and we used to have to do it when they were living in Albany, we were living up here. Every weekend, we would take a 3-hour tour, so to speak, go down there, spend the night, and come back up the next day.
Okay.
So after a while, we said, no, this is getting too much, and we found a place for them up here in Bedford, and moved them in there, and it's a lot easier travel.
Right. Yeah, makes it a lot easier to be closer. So tell me a little bit about at what point did you retire?
I did not retire from the military. Okay, but I did do my 8 years active duty. I went to work for GT Wireless. I spent 3 years as a contractor at GT Wireless. Then I got hired on. I spent seven, 8 years at GT Wireless. And they have a system where you have enough numbers, number of years in, and you're at a certain pay level and so on and so forth, that you can go ahead and retire. And I did.
About what year was that?
That was the 2004.
So after you retired, what did you do after that?
Oh, now it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. Once I retired, sometimes I wish I was still at work. But anyways, you start doing all the things that you didn't get a chance to do while you were working. You kept putting it off. And then again, when my parents moved up, we take care of their house as far any kind of outside work and like that that needs to be done. Or any kind of, you know, the TV's not working or the heater's not working or whatever. So you get to do that kind of stuff, plus taking care of your own home. In 2016, while I was still working at GT Wireless, I was also through the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps League. And I became friends with the managers at both the Swanee and the Alpharetta Wild Wings cafes. And I asked them if I could go ahead and play Toys for Tots box in those locations through the Marine Corps League that I was in, Marine Corps League detachment I was in. And I would go ahead and put the boxes in. And then, for some reason, I decided to put on the Santa suit, and I would solicit the tables and on certain nights, and I would go up to people. I said, you know, I'm with Marine Corps League Detachment, and, you know, like, we had donated Toys for Tots, okay? And I would probably come back with about $300 or $200. It was like a competition going on between what I would get in Alpharetta and what I would get in Swanee. But anyways, we would take that money, and Toys for Tots has their own rules and regulations where they go ahead and I think the age limit is 11 or 12 are the only ones that get the toys. 11, 12, and below. 12, I think 12 is the cutoff. So you could imagine going to a house and delivering Toys for Tots, and there's a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old in the house, and the only one that's getting any kind of gifts from Toys for Tots is the 12-year-old and down. So we decided to go ahead and take this money, and we would do two things with it. Number one, we'd go ahead and buy some higher-end items for the 14, 15-year-olds. And we would also go ahead and make up food baskets and give them to families. So the money was going to a good cause. Besides the fact we would go ahead and take the toys that we got and instead of turning them into Atlanta, we do go ahead and have different groups up here in Gwinnett County, Hall County, get the toys, you know, come down and get the toys, and distribute them. So, like I said, at that point in time, I would get into a Santa suit and do that. And then it got into a little more depth. I started going to Santa schools, every single one I could get to. And at the Santa schools, you start learning how to really portray Santa. And I still go to some schools today, because you always learn something new. You learn how to deal with people with special needs, because they're children too. You learn to go ahead and deal with people who have dementia. They don't recognize their own children, but they know who Santa is. So now, I've been doing Santa since 2016. I became professional Santa probably around 2019. So I've been a professional Santa since 2019. And I'm still doing it today. By professional Santa, I mean I'm school trained. I do have a background check. I do have insurance. So when you get to that point, you are considered as being a professional. Also, now I do get paid for my performances. And I also go ahead and still do benefit nonprofits and like that. So that's where the Santa comes in. Now, that being said, I also became a member, a board member, or actually just a guest member of the Sugar Hill Historical Preservation Society. And in 2020, I became a board member of that organization. And Sugar Hill is known for two main things, gold mining and moonshining. Well, I know I couldn't come up with a character that would be very beneficial to the city if I was a moonshiner. I'm working on it, though. But anyways, I became the gold miner. And my name as a gold miner, which was, and you're going to get a kick out of this, in front of one of the restaurants and the museum, there is actually a water feature, and it shows a gold miner panning for gold. Well, there was a young lady who somehow named that water feature person Otis. And she looked at me, because I was dressed up as Otis for one of the Sugar Rush events, and she goes, "You're Otis." And that's how I got my name, Otis.
Very interesting.
So, anyways, I went ahead and I portray two characters so far. One is Santa, and the other one is Otis. And with Otis, it's very enjoyable because, again, just like being Santa, I get to intermingle with people, young and old, because I can tell stories as being Santa. I can tell stories as being Otis.
So, with being Otis, how do you interact with the local school system and field trips, those types of things?
I thought you would never ask. Mm-hmm. Okay, so as Otis, I am actually looking like a gold miner. Last 2 years, well, let me back up. We have a sleuth box, okay? And we bring the sleuth box out during Sugar Rush. And I've been making some of the former members of the Historical Preservation Society built it. And I kind of not really took it over, but took it over and made some enhancements to it and so on. So we have it down there, Sugar Rush, down by the splash pad, where the children can come up and pan for gems. Well, we did that, and I was not Otis at the time. And I look at it, and then when I became Otis, I got more involved into making it look as original as possible and doing some enhancements and so on and so forth. And yeah, you can say I took it over, but, you know, anyways, going right along. So the children come down and they were paying for gems and everything's, you know, taken care of by the city. And it was great. Well, 2 years ago, somebody got a hold of the principal of the school, said, "Hey, we would like to go ahead and have a field trip where they come down to Sugar Hill. Fourth graders come to Sugar Hill. And they go to the museum, and they go talk to the mayor and council members, and they make a full day of it where they are actually in their studies. They're learning about city government and what took place during the time of the gold rush and so on and so forth." So we had to display not the sleuth box, but Otis was down there. And he was showing some different ways of panning for gold and so on and so forth. Well, that worked out pretty good. And then, as you know, we have Gold Mine Park. oh, this makes it even better. So now, last year, I think we had about 500 people come through. We had the sleuth box set up out there at Gold Mine Park. Otis was there. And right away, the water was about 30 degrees inside the sleuth box. And the children are coming up, and they're starting to roll their sleeves up. And I'm going, no, 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 no. you're not going to get wet. And I show them what the temperature of the water is. And because right away they want to start panning for gems. I go, this is what we do for Sugar Rush. We pan for gems. But we're not doing that today. I'm going to show you how to actually pan for gold. How many have you been to Lake Lanier? How many have been to a creek? How many have been to the river? How many have been to the ocean? Okay. Well, you can possibly find gold in any one of those locations. And then I show them how to actually pan for gold, what they need in order to do it. And we have found, because I'm using actual dirt from the creek here in Sugar Hill, and we have found a little bit of gold. But I also tell them that if they find a nugget, and I show them the size of a nugget, they call 1-800-OTIS. So I will test them all through the presentation. And when I get done, I go, and you find a nugget, who are you going to call? And they're all yelling out, 1-800-OTIS. And the teachers are just, and the chaperones are just looking and saying, sure, they can't remember their lessons, but they can remember 1-800-OTIS.
That's great. That's great. Well, we appreciate what you do with the youth in the area.
That's forming young minds.
Yeah. You also help out the city and the Sugar Hill Historic Preservation Society with events related to the cemetery as well, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what you do for that.
Okay. Being a Marine, and I'm not saying former, I'm not saying ex, being a Marine, we have 130 some odd veteran graves in our cemetery. And during Veterans Day and Memorial Day, we place flags on these graves. Well, it's very difficult to go by a list of names to put flags on the graves, especially if you have like the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts or any other organization that's doing that. So I came across a flag stand that goes next to the grave. And we put a blue flag, one of these like flags they use for marking water line, like that, construction. Mm-hmm. We put the blue flag in this holder at each one of the veteran graves. So when it comes time to put the American flag in, all they have to do is find the blue flag, take the blue flag out, and put the regular flag in. After the date, we go ahead and take the flag out. And you put the blue flag back in, and everything's back to normal. That's one. Number two, we've gone ahead, and my wife and I, and all these flags and like that, we get from the city, and we do the roundabout as you come into the city. We do it for Memorial Day and Veterans Day, also for the 4th of July. We'll put flags in the roundabout that we going ahead and put holders in. It just makes everything look, again, the small town feeling. So we have that roundabout, and now we have a new roundabout that's down there in the cemetery around the flagpole that we do the same thing. The other thing is we have different groups come through and clean the cemetery stones, headstones, and they also put gravel, making our cemetery look very presentable. And the families of the people that are in the cemetery they are very appreciative. And in order to go ahead and wash these stones, they need to have water to wash down the chemical that they use on the stone. So I've got a tank that I put on the back of my truck filled with water and supply the water for them to be able to wash down the stones. Otherwise, they'd be pulling water from the front of the cemetery all the way to the back, wherever they were working. So, yeah, I do a little bit of cemetery work. Kathy and I both. You know, I can't take all the credit. And like I said, the city is very appreciative. They go ahead and they supply the flags. They go ahead and I send them a an order for the holders. So everything is basically taken by the city and provided by the city. I just supply the work, or we just supply the manpower.
That your volunteer work that you do for your community is very remarkable, and I know the city, the community, and all of its residents really appreciate both what you and Kathy do for our community. Is there anything else that you can think of that I may not have asked you that you would like to add in your interview today?
Just remember one thing. Even though the buildings are big, the traffic is getting bigger or more, just remember, it's up to all of us to try to keep the small town image. Even though, like I said, the buildings are big, traffic is more, but if you have it where you volunteer for things or you just mingle, I mean, go down to the promenade, go to the different restaurants. There's always something going on. Go to the Eagle Theater. There's always free concerts. And also go to the bowl. The bowl has some great opportunities as far as different events that go on at the bowl. For example, okay, that's one more thing. This past year, Otis has been known to make appearances at the splash pad for the children. And what you wouldn't believe how many of the children actually recognize me as Otis. Of course, I'm dressed as Otis, but at the same time, they know me from the interactions we've had at the splash pad, not the splash pad, but at the Gold Mine Park. So, like I said, as long as you can keep that small town feeling and mingle with the people, you'll have that small town back again.
That's right.
That's about it.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your time today to give this audio interview for historical purposes. I want to thank you for your service in the military and all of your volunteer work. And I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recorder now.